Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
Well, and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. SP Futures down 39. NASDAQ Futures down 140. This is after a down day yesterday as we seem to be having a little bit of a issue with these long-term bond rates and so forth. They're back up again today. 4.54 on the 10-year. The Bund is up 5 basis points as well, so starting to have those things sneak up. And the dollar is going down a little bit, so we saw gold had a run-up yesterday. Gold and silver, not to back to where it was, but everything kind of moves sort of in, I won't say in tandem, but they all move kind of as a set most of the time, and the market has come way back from its drop earlier in the year to actually be up on the year. Then you have to ask yourself about the, you know, your investors as to whether they were very, very worried when the market was going down and it came back. Do you say thank you, Lord, for the fact that I'm back to where I was and I'm going to take a look at my portfolio and maybe get some help, and if you need it, get some kind of protection. If you need it, rebalance. If you need it, just plain, maybe you're too much in stocks for your age and your income. It's time to review. You either can take that road or you can take the vindication road. I was right all along. Don't worry, in Trumpy we trust thee or whatever, or in the economy we trust thee, or in Paul we trust thee, or whatever the hell it is, and markets always go up and only idiots sell. You can go down either one of those roads, and depending on your station in life, and if you're 25 and throwing 500 hours a month and you're I'd probably be in round two. I wouldn't be caring about it either. But if you're not, if you're retired and you have a lot of money in stocks and maybe you've got concentration issues, might be time to not seek vindication. Might be time to seek a little logic. But do we have Mr. Kevin?
Speaking of logic, right?
Speaking of logic, Mr. Kevin. Hey, I won't say he was part of the Stocks and Jack family, but a friend, George Wentz. He's sorely missed, Kevin.
Funniest character on Cheers by far. Did you ever hear him tell the story of his last week at Notre Dame?
I think he told. I actually went drinking with him a couple times. He's our buddy Doc's. He married George's younger sister.
Oh, okay. What's her name? Just first name. I'm just wondering what people
she's,
say to a tavern.
Well, the girls have. There was 5 girls after George. And her name is Marty. So they started with the. Where the hell did they start? But she's like the 4th girl. She's an M. One after is Nancy. Really kind of strange. Kind of strange the way the family went about it. They had 7 or 8 kids. Beverly family. I knew the mom really well because I mean George had moved to California after the Cheers thing. He's getting work out there. He's already at work here. He was no longer in Second City, but he was getting work out there. And but I'm wondering where the burial is going to be because her family, his wife's family, from here. George's family is here, so you know, maybe. I don't know if the burials be here or not. If it is, I'll certainly go to the funeral mass or whatever. But we went out. I wonder, Kevin, he was so quick-witted. For those that don't know, the Second City is an improv. So they'll run some skits. Then they'll all just come out, and you, the audience, will suggest 5 topics they'll huddle for a little bit, and then they'll run through a totally, what's the word, Kevin, where it's a impromptu act based on what you know, you might say.
We can go with improvised since they are the improv.
You know, you'll say murder in the street or something like that. And they'll like huddle and come out and make like a murder in the street look funny type of thing. And I mean, that's and so what he, I wonder if in Cheers, if they gave him, and who's the other actor's name? Cliff, what the hell?
Ratzenberger.
You know, he was in a few episodes of Hill Street Blues. It was like a crook. Anyway, but he, I wonder if those guys, if George was so quick-witted that he, they gave him like the general script, and he just ad-libbed during a script.
Well, if there was one place he really could have ad-libbed, it's right when the first time he walks in every day.
Yeah.
And they all yell Norm, and you know, Coach or Woody would ask him, how's it going? And he goes, something like, well, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and I'm wearing milk-bone underwear.
Well, all the family got to Marty and the sisters and my, I don't know if Dad was still alive, but they all got to be like extras sitting at the table at one point or another. Said it was a riot. You know, there would always be like, what, 10 or 15 people sitting in the place, like regular customers?
Sure.
And everybody got to go be a regular customer if you wanted to. But, like I said, a couple times I was with him, and we went to his buddy Peter Burns, who was a, I think he was on Crime Story a couple times, or he was an actor at Second City. Didn't get the same kind of accolades as George. Talk about two different guys. George, just kind of real heavy set dude. Peter used to work out like 4 hours a day like an absolute man. The guy was shredded. They're the best of buddies, and they'd hang out together. If ever there were two guys that looked different, it was these two dudes. But Peter was the broker behind the book, the board broker behind the book at IBM. He was funny as all get out. It was worth it to trade in that pit just to listen to him. He was that funny. But he and Norm, they went out to Saturday Night Live together, did a bunch of stuff. As a matter of fact, they were piling out of some bar together, and they accused George of being gay. This guy was in such good shape. Well, George is not gay. But, you know, it lends into a... you could tell a story about him going out of Notre Dame, but it also is probably my single biggest story is when Notre Dame changed from like a, well, I'll say our kind of place to Dollar U. Because George's dad was a Notre Dame fan, Southsider, go figure. And I'm going to say, well, George is 76, his dad would have to be, what, 100, 105, something like that? He had tickets, season tickets to Notre Dame, I think before Arrow was there, Kevin. And I got to believe they didn't sell out, did they, before Arrow was there? I mean, I don't know, but it was...
Oh, I'm not that old.
No, I mean, but... And he had, you know, there were season ticket holders to Notre Dame, and he had them for years and years. Of course, the old man dies, and the bill comes to the house. George went, and George writes the check. Guess what? He's George Went, right? So finally, the Irish decide, well, you know, he must be dead. So they sent him, like, this letter... We're like, you've been robbing us, kind of thing. We get way more money. You know, here you send somebody a bill, they send you a check. You would think you'd be happy with the transaction, right, Kevin? But no, not exactly. You've been screwing us like we know you're dead. It was probably a little better written than I just said, but not much. If you want to keep these tickets, we need $1,000 a year per ticket. And oh, by the way, we can only guarantee that price for 10 years if you pay now. If you just pay us for 1 year, it's liable to go up every year. So all of a sudden, you went from being the customer helping somebody out to being the guy who's screwing them, right? For having the nerve to write the check for the bill.
You're bad.
Yeah, you're bad.
We're switching to a seat license model, and... We'll still let you be dead and buy tickets for us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as long as so our buddy Doc sends him a check for 40 G. I mean, it's unreal, isn't it?
Everything about college sports is unreal.
And, well, you know, the one thing that's
I mean, it's out of control now, but it's built steadily to this. It's one of those, you know, one of my favorite expressions is you know, gradually and then suddenly. Well, this is definitely under the category of gradually and then suddenly.
Well, Kevin, do you, with all the money involved, and you know this better than me because you're there, I think with all the other stuff they're doing with the changing times and all the other stuff, I think the one thing they've kind of have, I won't use the term left out, the thing that probably is not growing as rapidly is the ticket revenue. And some of the places have added on to where they got 100 and some thousand people there, but I think a lot of schools aren't filling them up. And, you know, I mean, Ohio State surely does, and I think Notre Dame still does, although they don't call they
come close every week.
Yeah, if you, well, now the new it used to be a sellout. See, when we were young, Kevin, sellout meant, guess what, a sellout, right? But now if it's a individual seat, you can't sell because somebody will sit by themselves. That's not a sellout, right? So if there's a, you know, 300 individual seats around, then it's not a sellout, right? Or if it's a somewhat, well, most football stadiums don't have a pole in front of them, but if it's a obstructed view or something, they got all kinds of different ways where they can say there's a sellout with, you know, 1,000 seats empty, right?
Well, they do it a few ways. So yeah, they changed it to substantially every ticket is sold out, and so that was part of it. Southern Cal, by the way, this year is already a sellout, and probably is a real sellout. But then the other sellout,
is that the last one
I've seen during the basketball season lately for the women's games, more so than the men's games, of course. But where there'll be 1,500 seats left for the Notre Dame Connecticut game 2 days before the before game time, or 3 days before game time, and then the next day you say they're sold out. Well, what they've really done is they just dumped all the excess tickets onto the secondary market to whoever their third-party partner, quote, partner in quotes, is. And that partner will still sell the tickets because the same seats are open, but they will sell them at a higher price, and they won't sell them all either. So Notre Dame dumps them at a at a very discounted price. Say you have a $20 ticket, they'll dump it and the third party will pay $4 or $5 for it, and then they'll sell as many as they can. They'll sell as many of those $20 tickets as they can for, you know, $30, $40, $50. And so they'll still be empty seats in the joint. It's just that, you know, it's who's paying what for the empty seats.
Well, we just had a curiosity yesterday since the Sox. I mean, I'm not so sure Reinsdorf even know who the Pope even was, but now all of a sudden the Sox are all over this Pope thing, right? The last seat that he sat in for the World Series, what did they do? They made it gold or something, and the whole section is the people he went as a guest for the World Series back in 2005. That's the last time he was there before he went to Peru. And I guess he's a pretty serious Sox fan. The people have had the seats since 63 or something, Kevin. They still got them, those four seats. Whatever, they're believers, huh? But anyway, I, what you just mentioned, I went on there just to find out, by the way, their website is horrible. You can't expand the stadium into, you know, where the seats actually are. You can't really, you know, it's even the seating chart is terrible. But same thing, you got to go through SeatGeek. Now, how does that work?
What do you mean? How does it work?
Well, I mean, so does the Sox don't have their own ticket office? You got to go through SeatGeek. They'd farm
they
that
probably
out.
Probably do, but why would you duplicate all the functionality of SeatGeek?
The site's horrible. You can do a little better, at least.
Well, if SeatGeek is horrible, you can. I probably bought tickets off of SeatGeek before, but I don't remember anything about the experience. That's just outsourcing a function. That's pretty typical stuff. You know, it's like having someone do your website for you.
Well, if you get on there, you can get the season ticket package. Then there's a couple of 20-game packages that are weekend. Actually, even if I wanted to go to Sox games, that's what I would do, because they're virtually all day game, like Saturday and a Sunday, and like a Friday night game. So you get like 20 games all just on weekends. Then there's a weeknight package. Then there's a value package, which is sort of, and this is if we didn't have real jobs, Kevin, these are the ones I would like if I want to go to a Sox game. They have a value package, which is basically all the 1 o'clock getaway games during the week, and maybe a couple of like Monday night games or something. Because it actually is kind of nice going to a day game during the week if you can get off work. But obviously you and I can't. But I mean, if you could, those are the ones that are fun, right? In one man's opinion.
Well, yeah, it is. At least when I was in Chicago, it was.
Yeah. Well, we have all kinds of crazy stuff going on market-wise, Kevin. I don't know how much of it's politics. I don't think it is necessarily, because I mean, some of the stuff has been embedded for like longer periods of time, and I don't think you can really blame the 20-25 year run in the inflation and the money supply and current last two, whatever. I guess you blame it on all of them or blame it on none of them, whatever you want to do. But it's clearly a something that has been going on for quite a while worldwide, and seems to be coming to a little bit of a bump in the wall here, where the Fed is a little reluctant to turn the things on again. And the last, as we've seen these, and I'm waiting for actually tomorrow. You still get the Federal Reserve balance sheet every week. And last week, as we started to see these 30-year rates, and in a couple days in a row now, Kevin, they've opened up like at 5 or over 5, and then immediately they start sliding down during the day, which means somebody's buying the 30-year bonds. Now, it could just be regular market stuff or whatever, or it could be, I just happened to notice that slightly last in the last week, the Fed's balance sheet went up a little bit. So, you know, I don't know if they're going to try and keep them under 5 and buy some of them. I mean, I'm sure, you know, maybe Carl can dig into the deep detail. But my nephew has found one of these wacky sites, and I don't know how these people get their information, Kevin, but it's like somehow would... I don't see why you'd even have to report it, because we wouldn't. We are a brokerage firm. But it's trades that like big shots do, and of course everybody dives in there and looks for Pelosi and whoever else you're looking for. But there's other people in there too that maybe are celebrity traders of one sort or another. And he found there's a few people, and again, this is not market advice or anything, that have gone 100% to cash that haven't been in cash in 10 years. I mean, there's some fear on the edges of the market at this level. And I don't know what it is, if it's a combination of maybe the dollar, maybe the deficit, maybe the long-term rate, maybe some stuff is just too high, maybe in some people's opinion, maybe the market's kind of concentrated in a few stocks. But there seems to be a little bit of a wariness that I haven't sensed in a while. And it's not just me saying, careful with your portfolio. I mean, I never really try and say that the stuff is way too high and sell everything. I always take a much more individual approach that, who are you? My nephew's daughter that's got some money, a few spider shares, I'm not going to tell her to sell, for God's sake. But she's 2 years old. I mean, she's got time on her side, one would hope. But I think I just will always say it's time to look at your portfolio and see where you are, because I've talked to people and they say, I've got the same stuff that when I talked to you like 7 years ago. And I'll say, well, that's fine, but 7 years ago you were working, making a $250,000 a year. Now you're sitting home on your ass. You're not working, you're never going to make another dime. It's a whole different program. It's not the market or my strategies, it's you that have changed. And it's kind of hard for people to realize that, Kevin. But you wonder, what do you sense? I mean, I don't know the future, but I suspect it's not going to be the same as the last 10 years, where you just buy, close your eyes, and if it's a bad month, you don't open your statement, and next month it's back. I don't think we're going to have that game in the next 10 years. I don't know what the game is going to be, but I suspect it's not going to be the same game. What do you think? Is that a broad brush?
Well, yeah, a broad brush, a couple of things. One is whatever else you think of it and whether you think it'll succeed or not, Trump is trying to do a significant reshape of the economy. And that's got to make people a little nervous that it will fail, nervous in terms of what will that mean to me or to my company or to my investments. So that's all part of it. But in addition to that, we do have a major repricing event coming up, where, you know, we've got a lot of debt that needs to be, federal debt that needs to be repriced in the next few months. And, you know, I think when you combine that with all of the other things that are going on with the U.S. economy, you probably have a lot of people saying, I don't know what to do. I don't know if we're going to be repriced. You know, lately we've been rolling debt over on short-term securities. Maybe, and they really want to do it with longer-term securities, but if that's going to be 8% because, or not 8%, if that's going to be over 5% because you're not certain, that's a problem. We've got just a few things at a time that are just pushing everything, and I hope it all works out well. If it does, that'll be great. But we, I have a very wait and see attitude, and I think that's where a lot of people are.
Well, I mentioned something yesterday that I think is, I think just in the way we're going to break here in a minute. But I mean, I want your opinion. We can back Kevin how this is going to really, whether it's going to make any difference, I guess is the question. I mean, I think, even though you and I argued about it a little bit, there's no question, I think, in anybody's mind who has a brain cell working it, that a tariff is a tax. Okay, now what's different about a tariff than say, a sales tax? And this is the way I think the CPI is calculated. Now, the CPI, we all, I think, agree that they've been lying to us for a certain amount there for 20-some years in housing and in medical, at least. But if they were to put, Congress and the President, of course, I guess you could say Congress wasn't involved in the tariffs, but they sort of are. By letting it go, they've been involved. If you put a 10% sales tax, national sales tax, and boy, I'm not recommending this, I think when the CPI comes out, if that's added at the cash register, I think it's not considered. You're always talking about the coupons and what price do people really pay, and by the way, you're very accurate on that. I think that they could probably get away with that not being in a CPI and still keep lying to people. I don't think the way tariffs are collected, they're going to be able to do that. And that's why, the big fight between Trump and the guy from Walmart. Walmart's saying, we got to raise some prices, and he says, you guys should eat them. Okay, well, now, if they do, and they say it's an 8% hit, which is what Hal estimates, if they do, I don't know what Walmart's margin is. You probably do. I mean, I don't think it's going to affect the stuff in the food store 8% at all. So, because I don't think they have 8% margin in the food area, do they? But if Walmart has to drop their margin by 8%, well, something's going to happen. It's either, if it's not going to be CPI, it's sure going to be in the WMT price, won't it? You would think. Because they're not making... So, I mean, this one's going to be pretty hard to hide, I guess. So let's go to break and just see, what's as it works its way through. And, we can argue about whether who's going to eat what where. And I think all the people on the show kind of agree that you almost have to look at every single product before you come up with that statement, which makes it really complicated. But, let's just see how that works its way through. And if Walmart does eat it, I'm saying I want to be short Walmart, don't you? The stock, I don't think they're going to eat it. I mean, S&P futures down 33, NASDAQ futures down 115. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Low No Fake Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tim Howe. We have the double-headed monster of Andrew and Jimmy over on the board this morning. S&P futures down 33, NASDAQ futures down 118. So we've got like 10 fingers hitting stuff. Makes me a little worried. But the Dow futures were down more than 400 to down 343. Now we've come back a little bit. I'm over in Europe. We've got the DAX is up down 50.2. We've got FTSE down 4. Call that flat. CAC around down 42.5. So they're up yesterday and they're kind of hanging in there pretty much today, too. So they have not really followed us down here the last couple of days. Nikkei down 230.6%. Hang Seng, these guys have been up because China has lowered a key interest rate yesterday and they're still kind of following through on that. I don't know how the hell those guys have any monetary room to move over there, but they seem to think they do. Hang Seng up 146.6%. Shanghai up 7.2%. They actually had a reasonable move to the upside on mainland China yesterday, which really hasn't been moving much lately. Bonds. 10-year up 5 basis points, 4.53. We've got the Bund up 5 basis points, 2.65. Japan up 1.53. So these are getting sort of in rarefied air. Not rarefied, but at least recently. And Nancy was saying how the mortgage rates are really creeping right up with these 10-years. So if you're not locked in now, you're getting a little bit of a 30-year yield is over 5%. 10-year hits 4.5. So this 30-year stays over 5, that's going to raise an eyebrow, I think, in terms of stock prices. Oil up 53 cents, but still 62.56, kind of in this low 60s. Brent up 51 cents, 65.89 net. Except for the one drop down in the mid-50s and a bounce right back up. Oil's been very uninteresting lately. Gold, however, is starting to come back. It's not up to where it was a few weeks ago, but it's hits 1 week high of 29.60, 33.14. Silver up 76, 33.33. We got a nice silver position for today. If it wants to go just a little bit higher, that would be nice. Not that we're rooting, that we were not cheering here. We're just saying. Dollar is down a little bit as the euro is up to 113.3. It was down to 111 something maybe 10 days ago. So that's a 1.5%, 2% move in 2 weeks in a foreign currency. That is a massive move. For anybody who has never traded currencies, that's massive. British pound over 134. Again, that was down to 132, so that's a pretty good move in there as well. Crypto, up $39, 106.673. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
Well, Tom, we have today in Chicago, it's 52 degrees. The high will be 52. In Phoenix, it's currently 68, partly cloudy, and the high will be 95. On traffic, inbound Kennedy is 38 minutes, inbound Edens is 33. Inbound Eisenhower is 22, inbound on the Ryan is 14, and inbound on the Stevenson is 9. Quickly in sports, the Sox did beat Seattle 1-0 at home. The Cubs beat the Marlins 14-1 in Miami, and Arizona lost to LA 3-4. In the NHL, the Panthers 5, Carolina 2, and in the NBA, the Timberwolves, the Thunder crushed the Timberwolves 114-88. Back to you.
Nice job, Jimmy, your first time through. We're never going to get one as good as Angelique's, though, are we, Kevin? Her sports report?
Who cares? All they do is lose.
Are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, we're never going to get one like hers. All they do is lose anyway.
Who cares? All they do is lose.
Yeah. What a great line. The question, before it's there's so much out there, Kevin, on this stuff. I was reading something yesterday on CNBC about so many Chinese companies now have decided we're not going to be their only port in a storm, and they've redoubled their efforts to find other markets, and you know, some of that stuff's never coming back here, even if all of a sudden, whatever we do, they want us. How flexible do you think? Here's the thing. It's hard for me to even talk about it, even though I do. Every single item from the work I did on this in grad school, every single item is like its own story, Kevin. And there's like a million items. You know, it's okay. There's a tariff on it. Is there a competitor here? If not, well, and that's in one category. If there is, it's in another category. If there's four or five competitors here, they don't really have the possibility probably of raising all their prices just for laughs. If there's one competitor here, he might raise his prices more than the tariff. Every single one, I mean, how do you get a grab on it other than if it's a specific thing you are importing?
Well, you don't. While we're on break, I pulled up a couple of things. What do you suppose Walmart's gross margin is?
You know, I'm going to say
January 2025 number.
For the whole thing or without food?
No, the whole thing.
I'm going to say 12.
I probably could find it broken out, but not during a commercial.
You know what? I'm going to take a real stab and pull this right out of my behind. I'm going to say 12%.
No, actually, it's 24.9%.
And food's probably 2, so the rest of the stuff's got to be 35.
Well, I was wondering how to come up with something for 2, and so I looked up Kroger because I'm not aware of Kroger doing anything except grocery stores. They might, but I don't know if they do. So Kroger is somewhat lower, but it's 23.5%.
Really?
Yeah. So that gives you some insight into Walmart, because if they're 23.5 and Walmart is 24.9, we're probably talking, I got to believe Walmart's markups are pretty good. So Walmart on food is probably way lower than Kroger's on food, because they're cheaper than Kroger. They sell the same stuff, but they're cheaper than Kroger.
Well, I told you the story. We had a listener, I don't know, who knows, he might be... a long time ago, we had a listener to the show that sent me an email, a lady, and she was saying that she had worked in retail, and you know, you know more about retail than me, but she said when she was younger, like Marshall Fields, if you got a men's suit, if they charged you $300 for it, they paid $150, that everything was kind of like double. And evidently, and she was saying that she went, I don't know, she got a new apartment or some crap, but she's buying a curtain rod. And she put her credit card through, and when they just came out with the scanners, they had new scanners in the place. It wasn't like they were just invented. She was at, you know, was it a Kmart or someplace, and they ran the thing through the scanner, and it came out with the price that they paid for it. And it was like a curtain rod, and she was paying like $20. She assumed, don't ever assume, right, that they were paying like 10. Their price popped up on the thing. They were paying like 2. So they've been pretty sneaky at upping the margins. I mean, I think on the stuff that you and I buy every day at Walmart, I'll bet the margins are a lot lower. But if you sneak off into another aisle, the small stuff, you know, the pens and all those kinds of things, I'll bet those margins are double probably, maybe more. I say this because I have a feeling, I don't have a feeling that I do the construction stuff that I still like to keep my finger in a little bit. You went to Home Depot, I don't think they're making squatto on the tile. But, boy, I think they're doing real well on the grout and on the glue.
Well, and that would be true of, you know, any, anybody who sells a large product mix is, they're going to be all over the place. So when you do it, the gross margin, of course, is blended. They probably have the data, especially the successful large companies. They probably know exactly what it is on every product they sell. When I was with Better World Books, we knew what the gross margin was on all kinds of, all of our different books. And then anytime Amazon, because we were a big Amazon seller as well, anytime Amazon made a price adjustment, all of a sudden you find your gross margins are underwater. And you have to be able to react to that very quickly. So I know companies know all, you know, exactly what it is on a unit level. It's just that you can't do business on a unit level. So you have to worry about your whole blend and your whole business portfolio.
Kevin, no, walk us through, because you do. Kevin teaches a lot of supply chain management, and I think there's a massive difference. And this is not a shot at anybody. We seem to be laying off a lot of people, like on the government. It seems to me in this particular area, the policing of this stuff, I don't think our people have their hands around just how almost invasive this policing has to be. And I use an example, a dumb example, and you take it through because you're the supply guy. If you and I are in the business of widgets, and we import them from China, and we just import them, and then we do something to them and sell them to somebody, so we sell the advanced widget, we're just going to have to pay it at that end, or unless we find somebody else and the other stuff we've been talking about. But if it's our company and we essentially own the place in China as well, you can't own it, you can own 49%, but if we're, shall we say, connected to the place in China, instead of bringing it over at $10 and charging people $50 for it here after we do something to it, why can't I just bring it over at $2 and pay the tariff on $2 and just adjust my transfer pricing, and now the markup is here? I mean, it's why I really shudder when you hear all these accolades about how it's going to cause, medicine to be made here. Well, if the person here or in Europe owns the place in India, and they're bringing penicillin here at $2 a shot before they stick it in your behind or in your arm, wherever they put it, and the shot costs $200 in the hospital, who cares? And they could lower the price coming from India to $1. What's the difference? How do you police all the transfer pricing games and the tariff? Who even looks at this crap? How could you?
Well, you can't. You could, and you can't. You have more capability to do it now than you ever did before, and that's a big. And government has been so uninclined to use the artificial intelligence tools. Now, remember, when we talk about artificial intelligence, we're not talking necessarily about Skynet taking over the world or anything like that. What we are saying about it is that it has the ability to just do the same work that you would assign to a human, only to do it really, really fast. So, for instance, if I want a company to use as an example in a class, and so I go to an artificial intelligence engine, I say, I want a company, here's the parameters. It has to be manufacturing in the United States. It has to have multiple distribution centers. I don't care what the product line is. I want to know what its strategic initiatives are going to be in the next few years. And let's see, what else do I want to know about it? Oh, and it's environmentally conscious. Okay? And I say, go. And I will have a response back in 40 seconds.
Well, but we also...
Now, it would take me to build that same case study. It would take me hours to do that. That's the same thing you saw with the Doge people going into government. All they were doing was running analytics against all of this kind of stuff and saying, here's what we're finding. This is why you get, why you fail to get people who are 150 years old on the Social Security rolls and getting checks every month. You identify those easily when you just turn loose a data analytics engine on it and let it go and let it tell you things and point things out to you. That takes minutes to go through several iterations, might take hours, but otherwise nobody's looking at this stuff because it's just a pain in the ass to find everything.
Well, you also have to, and this is not a shot at the current administration, this is a shot at like all of them, when you're big enough, they don't want to find this stuff on you. They could have found transfer pricing on drugs or on Starbucks for coffee or anything else in the tax rolls 20 years ago. If they wanted to, they don't want to look.
They could have done it, but right in today's world, it is easier than ever to really give it a good once over.
But I mean, there's not. I don't think. Well, I'm going to say I don't think this administration or Biden or anybody is going to hold something up and say tomorrow, we found these five big companies guilty of transfer pricing problems, and by the way, they owe us $20 billion, and by the way, three of their board members are going to jail. I don't see anybody doing that, Kevin. I mean, I don't.
I don't either, and I hope I wish they would start.
And I don't mean it's to me. This is the same iteration as the double Dutch sandwich, right? I mean, we don't want to know. If you're big enough, you can do whatever you damn well please. I mean, I'm more concerned. I mean, Carl's got me thinking this way, and I'll never admit to him that he's got me thinking differently. I'm more concerned if we really wanted to look at the overseas pricing and so forth. I would like to put, I mean, I like this for a lot of subjects. I mean, it's my style, I guess. If we have to, we'll have to kidnap people, 10 people from both sides of the aisle. Shouldn't have to kidnap them to bring them down to Camp David. They supposedly have great pool tables. And stick in a room and say, okay, we've got this problem with a lot of these imports coming in here. And some of it is child labor. Some of it's lack of inspections. Is it the problem that the penicillin come from India is cheaper because people are working for less, or the problem is because nobody inspects the facility? I've heard all kinds of stories from when you get past the age of 30, a lot of your friends have illnesses and so forth, and I've heard all kinds of stories, Kevin, that a lot of generic drugs don't work as well. They're not as pure. I mean, if that's the problem, you know, a tariff's not the solution. But it still is a problem, right? I mean, if we don't like the fact that some countries using slave labor or child labor, what do? Say if you let people work under 16, we're not buying crap from you. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer.
We have a law that says that. It's monitoring it now. It's the ability to monitor the source. Because what happens then is, but that's a good example, and that's why I'm jumping on it. We don't use the analytics tools that are available to find out who is sourcing is tracked, and it's pretty easy, especially if like a lot of companies are doing now, is they're putting all this stuff on a blockchain. All you have to do is follow backwards until you do it, and there's a whole lot of steps, and it's a whole lot of complexity. But if you turn a computer loose on it, they're fine with a whole lot of steps.
Yeah, but you're only going to turn it on if you want to find out the answer and you want to do something about it. I don't see anybody doing that, do you?
Well, I don't know, but I really wish that that they would do more of what we've seen over the last several months, because I think there's a lot of opportunities there that are falling by the wayside.
Well, I think it's somewhat selective. Anyway, let's not talk about that. I think it's somewhat selective where you're going, and I think one company can be ripping us off more than 10,000 people you laid off in Washington. I mean, it's just a question of where you're going, because you don't have that much time, like you've always said. I think Trump has bigger balls than most people that have been in there, but he seems reluctant to really going after the people where the money is. But maybe he will next year. I mean, I don't. I see this. Nobody seems to be able to touch his medical group. They don't pay attention to Supreme Court. They don't pay attention to anything, do they? They just go onward. I mean, last week we talked about the insurance company that's paying for the double lung transplant. I don't know if you saw that or not, Kevin. I'll give the story brief thing here. It was all over the radio here in Chicago. There was a guy, evidently, and I'm no doctor. Northwestern is having some success for some types of lung cancers to just transplant a lung. Evidently, some types don't metastasize quickly or at all, stays in the lung and it just kind of kills you there. But so if you transplant a lung or two, it appears, Kevin, from the time they've been doing it, it's, well, for lack of a better term, a cure, hopefully, or at least it's very promising. Now, it's a transplant, right? So it's a big deal. Well, evidently, this guy needs two lungs, and the insurance company, first they said they were going to pay it $1.5 million, and then they said, nah, we're not going to pay for it. And now, they're after massive amounts of bad publicity, they're back paying for it again. So my question is, I would love to see Northwestern justify that $1.5 million as being additional costs. I bet they can't justify $200,000, Kevin. Just saying.
Yeah, probably right.
And as one of the, I don't even know if the dude's alive anymore, but he was our guy when we were at Mesro, before Jim Tyree died. We used to clear through Mesro. Loved the place. Jimmy was a good friend. Horrible thing. He saved Marist High School, pretty much. Terrific man. He actually died at the University of Chicago because he had one of those things stuck in his artery. When they pulled it out, oxygen got in there and killed him. Ugh. And he was on the board at University of Chicago. How bad that was. Anyway, one of the guys that worked for him was our liaison, and his daughter one of those lupus things, Kevin, where you can never get insurance, right? Because it's a pre-existing condition, so she didn't have any insurance. She needed a transplant of some kind. So this guy's name was Stan. He pays for it. Well, I think you probably know, I don't know if the listeners do, but nobody can get any money for an organ or for something. So in other words, if I'm on a motorcycle today or a motorcycle hits me and somebody wants my liver for some reason, I don't know if they'd want it or not, but my family can't get a dime for that. You know, because they don't want people essentially, selling people's body parts on the open market. And I sort of get that. That doesn't mean that everybody along the line doesn't get a massive piece. So if it's my liver, the person who takes it out is going to charge an arm and a leg. And the transporter and this, the people who provide the ice cubes, I mean, you name it. I think Stan ended up paying $250,000 for the organ, whatever it was. Even though the person whose organ it was, by law, can't get a dime. Now, wouldn't you think that out of $250,000, if the family doesn't have enough money to put you in the grave, they'd just at least wing you a check for $10,000 for a casket or something? You would think that it would make it to the next person at zero cost, but it doesn't. The only person who can't get paid is the poor guy whose liver it was, that now is in a potter's grave. You can write fiction like this, right?
Yeah, I think I'm going to try. I should probably go rewrite my will just so that it says my heirs get a cut of the fees charged to process the organ. The organs themselves are free, and every value-added fee along the way that my heirs get 10% of it.
Well, you know the quote of your hero from Casablanca.
Greatest movie ever.
Oh yeah.
It was just on again a couple nights ago.
Matt Byrne, our Monday producer, just saw it. He goes, I gotta watch it again. I didn't catch any of it. I said, Matt, out of the 100 like greatest lines in all of moviedom, like 11 of them are in that movie.
Oh yeah, I have a playlist of all the best lines from Casablanca.
Well, your buddy, even though you don't may not think it is, I always thought Kevin's best buddy in there was Ferrari. Sidney Greenstreet was his line. There was always incidental expenses. Hey, what did Rick say? I always seem to be short a couple of bottles in the case. Well, there's always incidental expenses everywhere, you know that. Or something along those lines. And he's right about that. Everybody's got to wet their beak.
A long time ago, I changed my Twitter display name to one of the great lines out of that movie where Ugarte says, "You despise me, Rick." And he says, "I probably would if I didn't give it another thought." but that wasn't the line. It was probably I forget exactly how it flowed in the movie, But he said, I don't mind a parasite. I don't like a cut rate parasite.
What?
So I am now going by cut rate parasite.
Well, you know, the scene where he comes in and he says okay to the band to play the French song?
Yeah.
Well, evidently, the shooting was all over for him for the day. And then they got this to the point where they needed him. And he's across the street in the bar, already well lubed. And they went and got him and said it's just like a 30-second scene. So he stumbles back over, and he's standing there. And all he did is put the camera on him for a second. He gave the heads up and down. They played the French song, and he walked back to the bar.
Yeah, pivotal scene of the movie.
Oh, yeah, pivotal scene of the movie. I mean, hey, but Kevin, is there, whenever you get this, you know, we were talking about here yesterday, because my brother, you know, he talks to a lot of people on the phone, and, you know, in our clients, I'll say this for him, and it's why it's kind of enjoyable to do business. Kevin, virtually all of our clients, when they call, it's not just somebody whining. It's they have information. The conversations are terrific. You're happy they called. Guys have said, I just saw this. I saw this housing price went up or went down. Everybody, it seems that we have attracted as clients, has something going on in the world where they're not all just takers. They're givers. You know, which is really, when you pick up the phone and talk to people all day, it's kind of nice to like want to pick it up rather than not. You know, somebody just whines. I mean, we don't, fortunately, we don't have, and it's, you know, my brother talks to probably more people during the day than I do. And they're always coming up with information from stuff that they've read or they've done something. And there seems to be right now, normally when the market comes back like this, everybody feels vindicated. You're just a shoe clerk, you know, you sold when it was down and you're an idiot, blah, blah, blah. The tone is not quite like that right now. Maybe it's the interest rate piece. Maybe it's where people think there's something wrong with the fact that your mortgage rates have gone from 3 to 7.5, and by the way, the housing prices have gone up and not down. And I don't think people even know why they're nervous, but there's some nervous going on in the last couple of months that I haven't felt in a while. Now, it could just be all gone in a week, you know, or something, but what do you feel? I mean, you're in an area where guys are, I mean, we talked about this a little, I talked about this on Monday, kind of wishing you were on. There's a massive difference in the attitude of the people you portray in the schools and so forth, and people that are getting their next certificate and they're getting a little bit better job, and versus the people that I run into here that are already like kind of have their degree, maybe have some student debt, and they're locked into some dead-end regulatory job, and they never see their way out of it. They never see their way out with a car. They never see their way out with a house. They're way more depressed than the guys you're talking about. I mean, why is that? I mean, can you comment on that? Because there is a difference. I know you're right, and I know what I hear, but what are you seeing?
I think most people, they want some stability in their lives. And so a little uncertainty, not good. But on the other hand, you're also in an area that has lived through horrible terrible recession in the late 2000s. And everybody knows what that's like. Everybody of any age knows what that's like. You get younger people and they don't. They don't remember it. They were children at the time. And so we don't, you know, you don't see the same concern about it, but I think anything that that they see, anything that is a commitment to trying to spur U.S. manufacturing is good for them, because this is a manufacturing and distribution area. There's also a fair amount of optimism on the technology side, because, you know, where I live, we have these, you know, at least three, and I'm hearing rumor of a fourth, massive, you know, mega data centers coming into town, and those are good, stable, long-term, well-paying jobs, and so everybody wants in on that too. So, you know, I think there's an optimism here that is not necessarily there in the rest of the country.
What did you make of, I don't know if Russell's out again, we'll pine in on this. I don't know if you had a chance to listen, Russell probably didn't, interview with Bill Moriarty on Monday. I found that amazingly fascinating because he was saying that there's more serious projects, well, as many going on right now as there kind of ever has been. There's money for them. There's huge advances in desalination. There's huge advances in other stuff. And he says there just isn't anybody filling up the void of those kind of engineers. And he goes, to be blunt, a lot of the workers are from other places, and they've all fled back because they're afraid. But that you can change pretty quickly, I think. But do you guys, do you have anybody in your group that is heading for civil engineer stardom or anything like that? Or is that just a lost? And Bill says there's just not people 30, 35, 40 years old that are the up-and-comers that, you know, are going to put in the next dam or water treatment facility. He goes, there's money for that all over the place. What do you mean?
Yeah. It's not my area anyway, but in community college, you don't have a lot of engineering students. We do have an engineering program. It's a small group, and that's people who intend to get their engineering degrees, their bachelor's degrees in engineering, but they're here with us for whatever reason, you know, often just to save money on the first 2 years. I don't encounter a lot of it.
I was just saying the real issue within the engineering space, and I just know this from we have a joint program with Purdue, so I do have some students that are doing a couple of business things that are really Purdue students. They're all interested in space, man. That's the problem. That's what they all want to, that they're, because there's, you know, that's just the high profile thing that's going on right now. I had a godson that went down to University of Texas. He was going to become a petroleum engineer. That was the thing he always wanted to do. And after one semester, he switched over. And now, I think I've talked about him a little bit. He works for SpaceX. So he went to Texas I was on a panel at NASDAQ yesterday with a guy that I think runs the engineering department at Texas A&M.
Wow.
And you would think, I've already ruined I've ruined the outcome here by talking about space up front, but you would think if you had an engineering guy from Texas that his discussion would, you know, that he would be talking about the energy space, et cetera. It was everything he talked about in the panel was about public-private partnerships. Everything he talked about had to do with space.
We don't want to be an astronaut.
I think that's part of it. And you see the same thing in the financial space. I mean, I've gotten more freaking questions about private equity in the last couple of years from undergrads than I think I have in you know, the previous 30 years of being involved in the business. And that's just because that's what the high profile thing is right now. One of the things that I try to do is I try to instill, depending on your personality, the high profile thing's not what you want to do. You know, I have plenty of students that you know, will do great in the corporate world, you know, starting out in the accounting department and working their way up. And then other ones that are going to be attracted to what the really what the really hot thing is right now. And I think our job on the education side is making sure that our students are aware there are other things than the thing that you read about from day to day. Like when I teach bonds, which undergrads, all they know is the stock market. You know, I try to explain, you can probably have a more stable and a very lucrative job working in fixed income. You don't necessarily have to be involved in the stock market, you know. And I think that I assume, you know, space, it's not my primary space, engineering, that it's kind of the same thing. You know, what's really cool right now is, you know, making video games out in Silicon Valley, or is it being a quantitative guy in the financial industry? It's probably being in Silicon Valley right now, but if the stock market starts making new highs and a couple of high profile quants start being the heroes of undergrads, they may, those engineering guys might be looking at the financial world instead.
Well, Gene Pearl, who, where she retired, was a director of admissions for engineering at Michigan, and she said everybody the highest paying things her last couple of years people were coming out with like computer engineering, which is not the same as road engineering, and people move towards something like that. And but you know, like what Bill was saying, there's an awful lot of money in this other stuff, and plus everybody wants it. I mean, everybody's going to want desalination plants. You're not going to be able to get a drink of water. You know, maybe it's the lifestyle. You have to go from place to place. It takes 5 years to build one, and you got to go somewhere else. But whatever it is, it's somewhere along the line, we're not diversifying across a lot of these lines in some of these areas. I mean, I think, but
I think it's the engineering school's responsibility. It's my responsibility when I teach undergrads. You know, the general finance class that touches on everything, that touches on corporate. Stocks, bonds, and even a little bit of derivatives, to say, here's what you can do with this. And one of the best students I've had down in Indiana she was taking classes at Ivy Tech when she was like a junior in high school, so she finished in 3 years. She is first generation, college student from a family, and probably has half a dozen younger siblings. Thrilled to be working in the accounting department at Cummins Engine. Just absolutely thrilled to be there, thrilled to have that kind of a steady job that her, the previous generation in her family never really got to experience.
Well, I'm gonna at the risk
you can sell that to a certain you can sell that to a certain type of undergrad, and it should be the best decision for them as well.
At the risk of jumping into a pond with the creature from the Black Lagoon with the three people around the air, I'm going to say the thing that is absolutely similar to the three of us, where all we do is joust, is all of us around about our third or fourth career.
Yep.
And everything that you...
I always talk about the three careers.
Well, everybody I talk to about going to college now, and they're going for this, they're going for that, and I go, if you get a chance... And if your school allows it, which some of them don't anymore, which is kind of screwed up. I mean, I think Kevin would, if you're dying to be a supply chain guy and you got a chance to take a semester in accounting, grab it. Or if you got a chance, because somewhere along the line, I don't think I've ever had a class except maybe philosophy, where I have not at some point used what I learned there. I mean, and the more you spread yourself out, the more valuable you are to somebody. Even if you want to be a computer engineer, it doesn't hurt you to take a couple classes on building a highway, because who knows? There might be a job someplace somewhere, and you want it, and that way you can go get it. You can't otherwise. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think. I mean, you guys are educators, but whatever you can take, branch yourself out. You might be surprised what you might learn. That's just me. Just saying.
You know, the class this will so off topic, but it's stuck in the brain. The class like that influenced me the rest of my life was Introduction to Art Appreciation. I'm the only person in my house that's allowed to hang pictures around the house because I understand all the sight line. I just found it fascinating. My wife is staring at me and laughing right now because it's true. Like, I came with a great art collection. Everything on the walls around here came with me. I think in the graphics that I create and all the things I write, I think it shows up in there a bit as well. The strangest thing.
I was saying, full disclosure, Russell, two things. I have some talents in a lot of areas, I think, and been God-gifted. Art is not one of them. And singing is, if I drew a stick man, he'd be a big fatso. That's how bad I am.
He'd walk with a limp.
He'd walk with a limp. I have zero ability at all. I can tell when I look at something.
Well, I can't draw, but I learned about how things draw your eye to a certain place in a painting and all this other kind of crap, and I found it very interesting and it stuck with me. And that's the kind of stuff that you hopefully get out of college by being forced to take a few things outside of your interest.
Well, yeah, and I think that would probably have been a little far. Maybe I could appreciate it, but I sort of couldn't do it.
Yeah, no, I'm not drawing anything or anything, but all the art that I'm looking at on the walls right now is it's organized in a certain way.
What do you make of
Kevin and I were kind of kicking around earlier.
Mm-hmm.
This we've had a big move down in the market and a big massive move back, and to the point where we were up. Now in the last couple of days, we're probably not up on the year anymore, but. And we've had interest rates moving up. We've had gold get clobbered. Now it's coming back. This is kind of the first time I can sense, maybe with our clients, I mean, as my brother Dan was talking to me about it yesterday, first time I can sense usually when that happens, the people who don't sell and have it come back and after being nervous when it was down, they're not looking to do anything different. They're not looking to revalue. They're not looking to take a look at I'm not giving anybody any advice on what you should do. My advice is, if your station in life has changed since you put the portfolio together, you know, maybe 10 years ago when interest rates started going down to zero, you need to take a look at it and say, and here's the question you have to ask yourself. If I didn't have one stock in here, I had nothing in here, my portfolio is $2 million. If a guy like Russell comes in and wrote me a check for $2 million, would I immediately take the $2 million and create this portfolio? I'm going to say in 99% of the cases, the answer is no. So if the answer is no, it's up to you to get from point A to point B. If you know how to do it on your own, which most people don't, if you have the balls to do it, or you don't just fall back and say, well, it's been good to me so far, I'll just let it ride. Those are not the right answers, in my opinion. You could be just exactly what you want. It's possible. Mm-hmm. You could very well be that. But I'm going to say, and I noticed from like really serious, I used to trade all day long in the pit every day, and I had three people working for me putting spreads on and probably 40 other stocks on the floor. So our portfolio on my account was way more complicated than anything you've ever seen. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And so every morning we'd go through every single one of these positions and say, in this stock, what do we want? What do we got? And I'm going to say, well, some of them were simple positions, so we got what we wanted. You know? But most of the time, we're too short in this one, we're too long in this one, our time decay is too bad in this one. Almost every morning we'd have 50 orders on the floor to adjust from where we are to where we wanted to be.
Uh-huh.
And if it was a big move or the day before, it might be 60 orders. The idea that you put something on and you just live with it and it's all fine, I don't know where that comes from, because there's a big difference between me and a surgeon. There's a big difference between you and me when it comes to portfolios, because I've been doing this for 35 years and I got really good people with me, maybe 40 years. And there's... You need to adjust all the time when the market's moving like this. And you need... We used to have positions on a protected index program also. If we rolled the puts twice a year, it was a busy year. Stuff didn't move. It went up a little bit. Maybe the end of the year, you're up 6%, and you roll your puts up, and everybody's happy. You sell calls. You make money on the calls. Well, now you're chasing calls. You're rolling the... But we've rolled the puts. If we do it today, which we're probably going to have to, not have to, we're going to want to, we've adjusted the puts in the GDX position 4 times in the last 3 weeks, as it's gone from 51 to 46 back to 49. I mean, to say that everything's fine or everything's the same as it was 2 weeks ago, you should never say this to people, but it's stone cold ignorant, especially if you had a change in life in the meantime. If you retired, you got a job change, something. You know, I mean, we're talking about long-term rates being 5%. Now, am I going to say, hey, sell your stock and put it in a 30-year bond at 5%? I'm not going to say that. But I'm going to say it's not 2% anymore. Keep your ears open, right? That's not telling somebody to trade. It's saying be aware that the world is different at 5% than it was at 1.5% or 2%. And if it goes to 8%, which I'm not predicting, the world's going to look a lot different, don't you think?
Oh, very much so, yes.
We've been talking about the complexities of how the tariff issue is going to pile out. And one thing I did kind of, and I want to know if you agree with me, I think the CPI, if the administration would put a 10% sales tax on everything, I don't think that number gets in the CPI.
No, it doesn't.
But the increase...
You know what? I had another professor give me a book recently that talks about how the CPI is calculated and what it's really supposed to do. And it's not designed to tell us how much things go up in price. It's not really designed to tell us... It's really not designed as an inflation indicator.
Well, which most people think it ought to be, right?
I mean, I know, but no, it's just not. That's just not what it's just. It's designed more as a, you know, it's a basket of goods indicator as opposed to our day-to-day cost of living indicator.
Now, when you say designed,
mm-hmm.
what do you mean by that?
That I mean, its purpose is not as an inflation indicator.
I'm going to push back a hair.
I'm just. I lent the book out to my my daughter who you will see next week, and she's got it right now. But basically, what they describe the CPI as is more of a just more of a macro indicator as opposed to being a true solid indicator of our year to year increases in cost of living.
All right,
but the CPI people don't care about that.
Well, I'm gonna
because that's not what that's what some Bureau of Labor Statistics people in interviews were saying.
Okay, and I'm gonna push back age wise.
But they're saying exactly what you've been saying about it forever.
Yeah, but I do say once in a great while.
I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, well, what I do say
from the outside.
Once in a great while is when I entered the business scene, one of my jobs at Pullman was to be the inflation master.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say back in 77, 78, 79, up to 81, the CPI, maybe 1 month where they said it was up 1% and you thought it was up, 1.1 or 0.9, you could pitch a bitch. But I'm going to say nobody ever thought that the thing was so far off you couldn't use it. It was used in every contract, and people.
Well, it's still used.
What I'm saying. Well,
it was it's used for union contracts to determine raises. It's still utilized, even though it probably shouldn't be.
I mean, for the last 4 or 5 big contracts, and I haven't read the whole thing, but when they talk about the Caterpillar contract, the GM contract, nobody, maybe it's just the reporter, nobody's mentioned a CPI.
No, I'm not talking about private, I'm talking about public.
Oh, yeah, like, okay.
Every teacher's contract under the sun has CPI in it.
Okay, but what I'm saying in those days,
that, yeah.
If the CPI was up 1% in a month, which it was a bunch of times, by the way, our contract with Boston was on a commuter cars was $60 million. I would sit there and go, okay, what's 1% of $60 million? What, $660,000, right?
Yeah.
So I'm gonna go.
That's $600,000.
I call them.
Don't make me do math for coffee.
Yeah, well, it's early. It's early. Because there weren't a whole lot of 1% months, but there were 0.1, 0.2%. So I'd call up and say, guess what? This thing just went up 1%. And they go, okay. It's $60,600,000, right? Mm-hmm. And they had the same number.
Were you using like the big CPI, or were you using one that was, or the part of it that was specific to your industry?
No, we just used this. Yeah. Everybody felt that the CPI was good enough. People had a faith in,
and then the other thing is, it's based on consumer goods.
Well, if I had it to do over again,
and that's why the tax part's not going to get in there.
I know what I'm saying is, it was good enough. If you and I would have put a contract together with Jimmy and Andrew 10 years ago to build houses for them, we're going to build them 10 a year, and our base price is going to be $250,000, and it's going to cost us $225,000 to put it up, and we're going to increase by the CPI. Do you think we're still in business? I don't.
Probably not. No.
I'm saying there was a time when people felt it should be accurate enough to be used for as an indicator for all people.
I mean, and I think that's in a time period, when we didn't have the ability to. Those numbers were all being calculated probably by hand somewhere. And we didn't have quite the insight and the ability to parse it like we do now.
Well, I mean, I guess
yeah. You guys were talking about profit margins, and I'm sitting here with a piece of electronic equipment in my hand, and I'm double checking the profit margin numbers you guys were throwing out there.
Were we right? We
kept yep.
Well,
nah, I don't. I, you know what? Not at all. But I. Yeah, he was talking about gross margins. Then you know their net margin is about 2%.
Yeah, I was talking more like net. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's all. I was like. Yeah, that's why I was checking.
Well,
the
I mean, where the conversation the net, started.
The net, you know what? The net margin at Walmart's about 2.8, and it's closer to 2 for Kroger.
Right. What we're
it's
talking
like
about
1.8 at Kroger.
For those that aren't,
and I just know that because I used to cover the retail industry, so I knew that I was like net margins is a lot lower than what you guys were throwing out there.
Well, with the context, Kevin, I'll mm-hmm. say this: Kevin wasn't necessarily.
I know.
What Russell and I are talking about technically here is. When you, if you buy a banana from Chiquita for $2 and you sell it for $3, your gross margin is 50%. But then, oh, by the way, you got people that had a stock, you had people that had everything else, you have lights, you have all other kind of stuff. Your net margin might be 2 instead of 50. So they're two separate numbers is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, either way, I don't see Walmart eating. Now, again, every product's going to be different. I don't see Walmart able to eat the whole 30% tariff if it ever gets to them at that price. I don't think it will, but if it does, they're not able to eat that.
Walmart's such a behemoth. They'll pressure their suppliers to eat some of it.
Well, yeah, but not all of it.
They'll pass some of it on. Yeah, and then they'll pass some of it on. And but we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Well, but my summation on old school CPI is. We never made it to the end of the year where the CPI went up 12%, and a lot of idiots like me and you are on the air going, "Wait a minute, it was really 6 or 18." It was pretty close.
It was pretty close.
But, I mean, that never happened. I mean, now were they off a little bit? Sure. Was it? I really think it was a lagging indicator, and I don't know why that is, but. But nobody ever said.
Well, it was a survey from the previous month, but then also, you know, we've talked about how they reweight the thing.
Yeah.
And they only if I remember correctly, to be 100% correct, I'm going to say they periodically reweight it. I think it's every 2 years. So that would make it a lagging indicator as well, because what people. Consumer trends do change, maybe not dramatically, but they do change over a couple of years.
Well, I can't put my finger on why, and I've asked everybody on the show who have all individual brilliant pockets in their mind. I don't understand why. I mean, I've said this a million times. If somebody goes out, like Mike Murphy's mom used to, and survey how much rice was and noodles, whatever she was doing, and sends that number in, you are correct. It probably should lag a month or so. I think it lags 4 or 5 or 6, and I don't know why. And it goes all the way back to 1977. I mean, this,
his mom was actually only going out like once every 6 months and just kept sending the same numbers in over and over again.
God, she'd smack you upside the head if you accused her of that.
But hey, you know what? If people were doing that in mass, there's your solution.
But I mean, somehow or another, I don't know why it. I'll tell you the story where I felt this way is once, I left Pullman. I was on the trading floor, and Volcker's doing his thing, and he's got his foot on the brake. And I think, I honestly believe he put the savings and loans out of business, but that's another whole story.
Uh-huh.
But the one time I think Russell there actually was wage push inflation was in that 6 to 7 month period where he had the inflation had absolutely stopped. Looking around, yet it kept coming through the CPI as if it hadn't stopped for like 4 to 5 to 6 months. In all those months, people kept getting raises, even though I'll use the term didn't deserve it. Now, they probably should have got it at the beginning, and they didn't get them.
Right. It's like a makeup.
Even this time, when the inflation kind of started during COVID and so forth, it was there before it was reported.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know what causes the lag. So I'm totally mystified by it. But I've seen it now for, well, since the 70s. It does seem to be a lag, and I don't know why that is.
Well, and I do think that if, you know, if the folks that are calculating these numbers at the BLS, if they see some real outliers, they may try to smooth things a bit.
It could be.
You know, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if, you know, like, you know, that doesn't look quite right. Let's, you know, let's tone that one down a little bit. And then when they find out they shouldn't have, they've got to play catch up.
Yeah, yeah. I got a question.
There's got to be some of that. I don't want to say gamesmanship. I feel like in their minds when they do things like that and they see a number that might look a little outlier to them, they're trying to err and be a bit cautious to make sure, you know, to keep some volatility out of the number as well.
Hey, somebody sent me a trivia question. We'll see if you, Professor. Is it true that Jupiter is so large that it does not orbit around the sun?
Oh, that other things orbit around Jupiter. Yeah, I've heard this.
Okay, I figured that's why.
And you're hitting on another area that I don't work in that I'm really fascinated by.
Oh, but me,
yeah,
too.
If it weren't for Jupiter's gravitational pull, we probably wouldn't be here.
Actually, what causes
it? That's how massive it is. Yeah.
What causes it? What actually is they kind of co-orbit. Like a point a little bit away from the sun.
Yeah, it's because they're pulling on each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what's fascinating for you guys?
Yeah, there are plenty of areas I have no interest in, but that's one that that whole gravitational thing, it keeps all the asteroids from hitting us. Is really just to try to keep it very basic for everyone. It's one of those things that it's actually like a big protector for us that's out there.
We're gonna head off to break. We come back. Let's talk a little bit about the what's going on with if there's some kind of recession. It seems to be. We were talking in the office yesterday that Western Illinois is having the town is doing lousy because the university can't attract students. You know, other places have piles and piles of applications they can't do anything with. Maybe you can.
I'm very aware that there's a disconnect.
Well, why don't we
go to break?
SP Futures down 30, NASDAQ Futures down 114. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks. Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you are aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. PTI, we have always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and try to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Andrew and Jimmy on the board. SP Futures down 34, NASDAQ Futures down 130. Been kind of flopping around here between 28 and, say, 40 on the low end, but it's kind of in this range. Been there pretty much most of the morning after a down day yesterday. Just individual stocks. Amazon's down $1.98. We've got Microsoft down $2.27. Nothing crazy. Home Depot's up. That earnings yesterday, it's up again today. It's up $1.45. We don't really have, like I said, not a whole hell of a lot happening in individual stocks that you can see over in Europe. These guys were pretty strong to the upside yesterday, which is interesting because we were down. But today they are, UK inflation has leaps. That's not good. For some reason, my computer is not leaping here. We have the 30-year bond has come out now is over 5%, 5.02. That's the highest tick we've seen. It's been over 5 a couple times the last couple days, gone right back down. But now today, I don't think it's, well, it may go down, but it's starting higher. 10-year, 4.54, so those are higher than we've seen. DAX is down 62.3%. FTSE's up 4, call that flat. CAC around down 50.6%. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei down 230.6%. Hang Seng up again today. They were up yesterday with China saying they're going to lower interest rates. I don't know what monetary flexibility they have, but they said they were going to lower interest rates. Up 146.6%. Mainland Shanghai up 7.2%. Bonds, and this is, again, this is the we just were talking about. The 10-year is 4.54, and the 30-year is 5.02. Higher than they've been in like a real long time. It's going to go right through the mortgage rates and other stuff. Oil, not going anywhere. It's up a buck, or up 93 cents, 62.96. So making a little bit of a move. It's up $7 from the low last Monday, or maybe it was a week ago Monday. Brent up 87 cents, 66.25. We've got gold, which is pretty good moves to the upside the last couple days, up another $19 today, 33.04, back over 3,300. Silver up 12 cents, 33.30. Foreign exchange, and this is where all the action's been. Dollar's down a little bit with the pound. Euro up to 113.2. It's higher than the 111-something that was there 10 days ago. Like I said earlier, 1.5%, 2% move in currencies is huge. The British pound's a little bit higher, 134, not much there. Crypto, Bitcoin doing great, 106.782, up 149. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
Well, the inbound Kennedy is now at 57 minutes. Inbound Eden's at 55. The Eisenhower is now at 61 inbound. The Dan Ryan is at 26. And the inbound Stevenson is at 53. And again, for sports, the White Sox beat the Mariners 1-0, playing again today, I believe at 1 o'clock. The Cubs beat the Marlins 14-1. And again, they also have a 1 o'clock game. Arizona lost to LA Dodgers 3-4. The Panthers beat Carolina 5-2. And as we know, and that's what we have. Back to you, Chief.
I didn't watch the second half of the Timberwolves, did you?
No, I did not, Chief.
I have a feeling they must have wung up a bunch of threes and missed, and the other guys just... I think this Oklahoma City team is, like, really good.
Well, what we do know is, I guess, Timberwolves were up by 3 at half, and then the second half was a complete different story. Again, Thunder won 114-88.
That guy's, what's his name, the three-name guy, Stevenson, he's had another 30-point game, I think.
I believe you're correct.
He looks like he's the new Michael Jordan, eh? He's pretty good.
A lot of people, that seems to be what people are compared against, yes.
How soon will he be out of Oklahoma City? I don't know if he spends his career there. We'll see. Anyway, thank you.
Russell,
to
you, Chief.
We have what's going on in the education world? I mean, you would think there would be a ratcheting down, and I'm not. I think actually from what you and Kevin talk about, I'm very jealous being in Illinois of how coordinated and how seemingly you guys are trying to people in Indiana are trying to make education. I'm not going to say cheap, but as relatively inexpensive as you can in all different levels.
I've been, you know, the night and day between Illinois and Indiana is just a bit, and a lot of it's just organizational. You know, there are University of Indiana, there's like I think there's 10 campuses that all, you know, kind of follow the same general philosophy. They're standalone universities, but they're all within the same system. And then the Ivy Tech thing is just absolutely. I'd never really even heard of them, other than this program, until I started going down there and encountering former Ivy Tech students that had, you know, moved on to Indiana University. You know, it's just a much more well organized system. It's not really a system in Illinois. You know, you got Western Illinois, you got Northern. I hate the term directional schools, but you know, you've got and they have nothing to do with, you know, the flagship university at all, not even in name or anything else.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Is there a difference in structure?
What's going on is there's actually, it's funny, there's a guy from University of Chicago that I had a discussion with like 15 years ago about the future of higher ed, and he said it's going to be like industries where a lot of the smaller players start to fall off, and everybody just wants to go to the really large universities, and lo and behold, 15 years later, we're there. We saw over a 30% increase in applications to Kelly this year versus the previous year. I mean, that's freaking ridiculous.
Well, what is, there's got to be some difference in structure. You sort of alluded to it. I mean, you have, I don't see any, which doesn't mean there isn't. I don't know that there's any kind of really good feeder system. I think the College of DuPage does a pretty nice job, and where the police
College of DuPage is a wonderful organization. Really, they are. When I decided I wanted to go back to school and do a second master's in financial engineering, I went to COD and took some engineering or took some programming classes first. And I know lots of people that have started out at COD and then gone to four-year schools. They do a wonderful job at COD.
But they're not, they're...
It's just unfortunate that whatever the entity is behind College of DuPage is not replicating that model throughout the state of Illinois. Instead of just doing it out here.
I get the feeling that
Ivy Tech does.
Well, you and Kevin are two different spots, and yet I don't know if you've necessarily met, but you have students that have. You both know, for God's sake, and I don't know that there is some sort of a route, for lack of a better term, through the Chicago junior college system right into Western Illinois or Eastern Illinois or Northern Illinois or someplace where you're going to be here for 2 years.
A four-year school.
That you're going to get to go to. You're going to come here for 2 years. You're going to learn business. You're going to learn engineering or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You're going to get your junior college degree. And, oh, by the way, next year you're going to be a junior at Western Illinois and you're going to be equal to all the other people in the place or something. I don't see that kind of coordination here. Is there, and I'm just not seeing it, or what?
No, there's not that kind of coordination.
Well, that's got to be a big problem. It's a huge problem.
Whereas in Indiana, and I almost feel like it goes through the state legislature, there are courses that if you take them at Ivy Tech, they are transferable to other universities and that are state universities in Indiana. I don't want to say it's purely seamless, but it's a pretty efficient process. And if you're at Ivy Tech, if you're taking classes that are transferable while you're there. If you're at College of DuPage, and your intent is to do a couple of, to do a 2-year degree there and then move on to a 4-year school, I think you're kind of on your own making sure that you're taking the right classes that you're going to get credit at the next school that you go to.
I get the feeling that the old loop down Harold Washington to slide right from there to Southern Illinois is not that seamless. I
doubt that it is. There's a, I'm not a gigantic fan of Loyola for a couple of reasons, but one of the things that they really do well, they purchased a junior college and put them in the old business school downtown. And if you do well in that junior college, and they did it to serve the underserved communities in Chicago, but they're doing it as kind of a private entity as opposed to the state doing it. They purchased a junior college. If you do well in that junior college, you can transfer into Loyola for a 4-year degree.
Well, I think that's a good idea.
But that's what the state should be doing.
Yeah, we're not big on coordination in Illinois.
No, we're not.
Not so sure
why. Because coordination does not lend itself toward graft.
Well, how much of it's funny when we
the less coordination and the more unusual steps from point A to point B. What was your line from Casablanca about the losses?
There's always incidental expenses.
There's always incidental expenses in the state of Illinois that you don't necessarily get in other states.
Well, you know, you,
that's the winning. I'm running for governor, and that's my tagline right there. There's doing away with the incidental expenses. Roads for governor.
Well, I don't know if you know it or not, even though you're there half your life now. When Indianapolis put on the, I'm going to use a big word here for the morning, when they constructed the circumferential. Now you know what that is.
I do not know what the circumferential is.
That's the term they use in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
When you obviously there's a lake you got to go around. That's why we were the railroad center of the world. When you built the expressways.
You're talking about. I refer to it as a perimeter.
Yeah, okay.
That's what we called it in Atlanta. And
yeah, the original term was. So there's an interstate highway that essentially goes through Indianapolis. All right. So
yeah,
but all these all the places that don't have a lake. The Tri-State Tollway here essentially is the same thing, where you enter and you go all the way around the city. You don't have to go through it.
Yeah.
There is a toll there, which kind of screws that up because people come through the city to not pay the toll. But in places like Indianapolis, there's the I-65 that goes through the city, but you can also go around. There's a big square. Same thing in Columbus, same thing in like every city around it. They call it, the original term was a circumferential. But what Indianapolis did, I don't know if you knew this or not, they annexed all the property out to the circumferential when it was being built. So any like little suburbs and stuff they might have had there all became Indy. Now Chicago, Illinois has more independent municipalities than any other state in the union by far. And it's funny, when my mom first married my stepfather, he had a job in Toronto. So before he could find a job back here, we lived in Toronto for 3 months, and I actually did first grade in Toronto of all places. But we lived in a little suburb called Don Mills. And all of a sudden, a couple years ago, I actually went up there to see a client. And just when Toronto proclaimed that they were now bigger than Chicago, or as big, and I'm thinking, but that doesn't make any sense. I go up there, and I'm thinking, I'm going to go find out where the hell we used to live, and I'm looking for this Don Mills. I can't find it. Well, if you look real close on the Toronto map, somewhere in Toronto now is the neighborhood of Don Mills that used to be the suburb of Don Mills. So they essentially got rid of all those, I don't know, they may be more efficient or maybe less, I don't know, all those little governmental agencies, and just said, no, we're all Toronto now. And Indianapolis did sort of the same thing. You know, if you drive up through Oklahoma, and I'm not going to recommend this to anybody, you're out in the middle of nowhere, and you're going to see a sign that says you are now entering Oklahoma City, and you look around and go, there's me and three jackrabbits out here. Where the hell's the city? They're out so far, there'll never be a suburb, I don't think. Or maybe if there are, there's a couple that are grandfathered in, but there's never going to be a new one. Everything's Oklahoma City. Now, I don't know if that's more efficient, less efficient, it's just different. I think. Ben, I don't know. What do you think?
I know for a fact that it's more efficient.
Okay.
And here's my case study behind it. Memphis, where I grew up, used to be the biggest city, and you know, and when anybody thinks of Tennessee now, they think of Nashville. But Memphis was about twice as big as Nashville when I was growing up. And it was, I mean, there was like a bitterness because the way they did the license plates was based on your county. If, instead of putting the county name, they would put the number based on the size of your county. And Memphis was one and Nashville was two. About, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, Nashville had a great idea to consolidate the city and the county government. They now have one mayor in Nashville. Memphis still has a county mayor and a city mayor, and they're kind of equivalent in power. It's just it's a mess. And that I think, I really do think that Nashville has turned into kind of an economic miracle based on the efficiency that they brought to government. And then it kind of got brought to the rest of, got brought to the rest of the town. And now it's unbelievable to me that Nashville got an NFL team and Memphis never did.
Well, let me.
All of Memphis ever won it, but I really do think that, and I think the big problem, and I know that a big problem with Illinois, having been elected to a school board and seeing how the school systems work in Illinois, I'm sitting in my house in the western suburbs right now, and part of my taxes are going to pay two separate superintendents for one for the grade school out here and one for the high school out here, because Illinois has high school districts and grade school districts. That, and when I got elected to the board for the grade school district out here, we were using Apple computers for the grade school and using Microsoft machines for the high school.
I'm going to lab on it.
That's how much of a disconnect there was. Plus, we're paying two different superintendents $300,000 a year. Think about how much the state could save if they just did away with half of the superintendents.
I'm going to lab on at your Nashville argument, though.
Uh-huh.
Versus Memphis.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to stay Memphis. When the transportation was river, they were number one. Reason why, mm-hmm. I think Nashville is now twice the size is they're on the way from Chicago to Atlanta. I-65 goes from Nashville.
I think I-65 helps with that. You know, they've got I-69 that does the same thing and goes through Memphis.
But I mean, Sam, nobody.
But they just have a hell of a time hanging onto those I-69 signs. They keep disappearing.
God. Well, what I'm saying is that more people are going to Atlanta than are going to Mississippi.
So yeah.
The road to Memphis, the road through Memphis, is not near as well traveled.
Well, the road to Memphis is how do you get to Texas?
Yeah, well,
and the idea, and then supposedly the Mexico border for NAFTA.
Or it's the IC.
They consolidated the school system, and now they've tried to consolidate the school system in Memphis. And basically, what has happened is the city school system is just drugged down the county school system, and all in the few suburbs that they have tried to create their own new school systems.
What would you have to do to people in Oak Park to tell them to become part of Chicago? You'd have to pull eyes out. There's no way they would do that.
I know. No, and that's what they did to the suburbs in Memphis.
Wow.
They did it about a decade ago, and now they're trying to reverse it. But there's something to be said where, I mean, really the big theme here is, you know, government efficiency or government being out of the way. And when you've got a, you know, in Memphis, when you've got to worry about, you know, the county authorities and the city authorities, or in Nashville, where you want to move a business and you've got, you know, one office of economic development you got to go talk to about it, Nashville's going to be an easier sell.
Well, I think you're right, but also there's and I don't know if you go through all the math on this stuff, which nobody ever does, right? I mean, maybe you guys do in class, but there's something to be said for if you have a tax body here that maybe you don't need, right? But they do something. If you pay somebody something and they turn around and spend the money you just gave them in the local community, and everybody pays taxes kind of on the same stuff, it's somewhat of an inefficiency, but it's not horrible. You know what I'm saying? It's like if somebody gets a job to put potholes on Cicero Avenue, and it's a local guy and he scams himself 10% higher on it. But the 10% goes to people from Cicero, and oh, by the way, they all go to the bars and restaurants and supermarkets in Cicero. It's aggravating, but in the aggregate, in the whole area, the money sort of stays there, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of not the same as when you see some of the stuff that's going on when you have like these national. I'll even include the tariff in there, or some kind of a national game where, you know, maybe a multinational place, corporation comes in, they get the dough and it's gone. I mean, they're not really paying local. I mean, if all the income taxes from, you know, say, what's it, Foxconn or someplace, if all that money disappears to wherever Foxconn is, and none of the profits, I mean, none of the people up top that are making the millions of dollars a year live anywhere near that place. It's almost like a giant sucking sound in some regards,
yeah.
I think. So, I mean, I don't know how you... Every one of these things, we used to try and model this stuff, Russell, in grad school, And on a small scale, that's why I'm so, and we'll shudder with these tariffs. On a small scale, it's really hard to analyze it. When you start talking 70 countries and millions of products and back and forth, I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're AI like on the Starship Enterprise. I don't see how the hell you put it all together and figure out whether you're gaining or losing.
You can't. I mean, you really, there's just so many moving parts. You got to do the best that you can with each part, I guess you would put it. You know, I heard you guys talking in the first hour about, you know, how do you, with this many moving parts, what do you do, for lack of a better way to put it? Well, what would you be doing at Pullman for anything that you guys sourced from outside? Would you be trying to lock it in as much as you can before the potential tariffs kick in?
Well, it depends on, you don't have that many suppliers, you know, so you can screw around on, like, locally.
Yeah.
You know, you can screw around on who's
going to... And that may be the case that, you know, you start... There's this thing you can do on Bloomberg where you can look at how different companies... You can pull up a chart that has a little line showing who sells to who, et cetera. And some of them are very complex, but some of them, especially when you get beyond large multinational companies, some of them are, you know... You got small companies that are dependent on four suppliers and five large customers, and that's it.
Well, when you're an assembler,
and you know that, but that right there, that should be pretty simple to figure out.
Well, when you're talking about an assembler of that regard, now the Boston commuter car, it was a 60 car contract. I'm going to say it was 450. I don't remember. I still have the stuff at home. I'm going to say it's about $450,000 a car back then, maybe half a mil. Might have been $35 million contract. So what did that come out to? You know, a little more than $500 a car. I put the bid together for the CTA cars. Later, it ended up being $650 a car for the CTA cars. Well, the big items are the trucks, the traction motors, the air conditioners, the lights, and the seats. And, you know, some of the other connectors, the cab signaling and that kind of stuff. Other than that, you're punching metal into a, you know, which is people working. You're punching metal into something that looks like a car, and you're attaching all this crap to it. As a matter of fact, Pullman had something unique. They called it an upside-down section. So, right, you're a smart guy. What does that mean?
An upside down side.
Yeah,
I don't know. Do they manufacture? I don't know.
What they would? They actually put a big piece of tooling together, where you put the assembled, you know, undercar, the assembled floor of the car, onto this tooling section, and the tooling thing would spin the whole thing upside down, because virtually all your equipment is attached to the bottom of the car.
So all the other manufacturers. That's what I was kind of thinking was, but it sounded so silly. Make the thing upside down and then flip it over at some point.
Yeah, but you're attaching your brakes. Your raceways for your, you're attaching your air conditioners probably underneath. All those kinds of things. The other manufacturers would just raise it up, almost like on a car thing, and people would work underneath and put it up underneath. But it's way more efficient to essentially do it upside down.
That makes sense.
But you watch this.
Give that man a raise.
Yeah, and
who came up with that?
Well, the only problem with that was in Washington when they did the first. What's the subway out there?
The Metro Metro.
Somebody bleeped up the undercar arrangement and height drawing. So you're supposed to be designed in such a way where if there's a derailment and a thing scoots across, you know, like the other rail, all the underside of the car, everything on there is supposed to be high enough to clear the other rail, even with the rail on the ties and not on the rail. It's derailed. In other words, you're not supposed to rip all the crap off the bottom of your car. Well, the one in Washington, they screwed that up. It was an inch too short. So whenever they derailed, I don't know how the hell they fixed it. It was a big project. If anything derailed, you end up ripping off your air conditioner and all the other stuff on the bottom of the car.
And in D.C., you want air conditioning on your subway.
Yeah. Well, it's yeah. You know, the air conditioners. I mean, your CTA cars.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how you got me going on this.
You can open up the window.
Yeah, well, you used to be able to.
You can't do that anymore?
Oh God, not for like 50 years. The last
one. Come on, I've opened up. I cracked the window on one when it really stunk.
That was the Green Hornet cars. Those things have been gone forever.
What you could do is, you know, the cars where they have the space inside that where a driver would be if they were using it to drive.
All right.
You could crack those.
But your CTA car is more than anybody needs to know. is actually a street car on rails. It's all electric. All the brakes are electric. Everything's electric. The doors are all electric. Your New York subway car is not. It's almost like a regular. It's like a regular train car. All your doors are compressed air. Your air conditioner. You can't separate a New York car because it only has some piece of equipment. It works two cars. A CTA car is 55 feet. Those are 75. And they have four doors on the side. You can take literally thousands of people on the platform, and within like 15 seconds, they can all shove onto that car. They have four doors on the side. The whole side like opens up to let people in. Where CTA car has two doors, right? But those all have air brakes like a regular train. They have all that stuff. Where CTA cars, you know, when you get near the end and it's slowing down, you hear that kind of clunk.
Yep.
You know what that is?
It's falling off of the electric part, or
no? It's actually a magnet that reaches down and grabs the rail. That's how you stop it the last couple miles an hour.
I did not know that.
It's all electric. There's no compressed air.
Knowing as much as you know, are you willing to ride the CTA?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Well, I just used to be an aircraft engineer that would never fly, so I'm just
curious. No, but I mean for in terms of people that put rail cars together. Really take pride in. Now, do I want to ride with the people that are in the car with me? You know, that's another question.
That is a different question.
But no, those, you know, and plus the things are so over-engineered. The Boston cars, Pullman originally built them for Erie Lackawanna, right? And they were 90-mile-an-hour cars. Well, Boston says, we want 120-mile-an-hour cars. I don't think a car in Boston has gone over 55 miles an hour in the 40 years they've been there. We want this thing to be able to go 120. Why? But it didn't take much. You beefed up the truck
a
little bit. You beefed up the. You know, we built those things. Boston was going to go electric.
Uh-huh.
So the trucks in there, the trucks is where the wheel and axle combination. There's actually fittings and room for an electric motor on every one of the trucks. And there's raceways running up to the roof, and the roof is designed to be beefy enough to handle a pantograph, the thing that's. Sticks up from the top and touches the rails, called a pantograph. They never did it. So not only does it not go 120 miles an hour, it never got electric. Never got electric.
They know they're underutilizing it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, electric is terrific. Unless you're someplace where it snows and ice all the time, and then you got those problems. But electric is great. They're nuts noisy. They're faster. Everything.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so what we talked earlier. We got. Like 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
There does seem to be a slight change in attitude, at least among our clients, this time. More people seem a little wary of this rally this last week. What do you make of this?
Yeah, do you feel like, we've been around long enough for this one, do you feel like this is kind of, I don't know if it's, I don't even know if I'm talking my book right now, but I just don't know if this is like when we got the Bear Stearns thing that was a canary in the coal mine for the rest of, for what ended up happening in the fall of 2008.
Yeah,
and I do feel like, you know, I feel like there's a day of reckoning coming in China.
By the way, the
financial system is an absolute mess. It's one of the, you know, when we got COVID and everybody started working from home, the big theme was, well, working from home was a trend, and this just exacerbated that trend. I think there's some negative trends in place in China, and having even just the blip of going a few weeks where they shut a bunch of factories down to deal with. To deal with the tariff situation, I think that's something that's going to speed them along to having some real financial troubles.
How do you?
I don't know how much of it's going to bleed over here, but one of the things that I try to keep a close eye on is what are they doing within our treasury market? Do they need the money? And they went from being the top holder of U.S. treasuries to number three now.
Yeah.
So that's a trend. And then another thing is, I actually had a former SIBO instructor with me last week, and we were talking about gold, and I you got to love when these kind of things happen. He said, you know, what do you think about gold? And I said, well, my big fear is I've heard that the Chinese have been loading up on it, and I'm afraid they may start selling in mass at some point. And I think the next day that gold was under pressure, they said it was Chinese selling.
Well, so allegedly they were selling after the deal, whatever deal it was struck. They were selling, they weren't gathering as much in, but that was
I try to keep an eye on are they doing things because they don't, because they need money.
Probably,
you know, because that's so just seeing that they continue to sell U.S. treasuries, I don't think it's because they found a better place to put the money. I think it's because they had to.
Well, I think I have two kind of issues with, well, a lot of issues with how they rant and rave and insult people, but the current administration is, I don't think, I mean, I went back and I've been studying this Smoot-Hawley stuff. Now, that was a different time and whatever, but I don't know that you can, in the world we have today, that you can end up a net winner by bringing other people down. I think we're too connected for that. As much as I dislike China and the way they run their government and the way they have people slaving away in factories and the way our corporations have taken advantage of that, I'm not so sure that if they collapse, we're going to be laughing about it. I don't think we are.
Well, I don't think we're going to be laughing about it, but I think it's going to be worse for them than for us.
Well, okay, but I mean,
I think it's going to happen.
Well, if you get
and here's the thing: if it does happen, you know, it's when, it's not if, but when they have some sort of economic collapse over there, you know, much like when they had a societal collapse. Do you really want to be dependent on them for anything?
Well,
do you want to be dependent on a country that you think is going to implode?
As you know, Russell, the theme of the show, maybe you don't know, is everything depends on everything else.
It does. We're all interconnected. It hurts.
I think a lot of the people here that have not, wages have not kept up for really 25 years. I'm not going to blame Trump or Biden or anybody. It's been a long time. If you strike. In other words, I don't want people working at 14 years old making $3 a day in China. I don't want slave labor.
No.
But I also know that if you paid people a decent wage, right now a lot of people in this country can't afford stuff.
No, they can't. And I know we're going over, but I was in New York yesterday, flew back. Two slices of pepperoni pizza at LaGuardia of $16.
Well, a beer and a hot dog.
My traditional breakfast, which used to be about my traditional McDonald's breakfast, which used to be about five, it was 11 on this trip. You don't want to sound like a jerk, but there's a really nice stability in the academic world. I couldn't imagine. In my family back in the 70s, my family declared bankruptcy. We had to downsize our house and all this other kind of stuff. I couldn't imagine going through something like that. With all the economic uncertainty that we have going on at the same time, I just have this huge sympathy for my parents when I look around and see,
well, Russell,
you know, see what's going on in the world.
We got a dash, but you know, so, what?
I'd
love to have, and if I had a bunch of gnomes around me like you do, and students, gnomes, what I'd love to do is some half-assed little study where you pick, going back to maybe 1975 or something, somewhere in there. In every decade, you look at hourly wage of median income, every man, and you contrast that against normal things people buy. I mean, against an hourly wage. I mean, how many days' wage was a car in 1975 versus today? I think hourly wages now, in some cases, you got to work an hour and a half for lunch.
Yeah.
Where I think in 1970...
Or just your first hour is what it costs to get you to work.
Yeah, I mean, when we started going to Cub games in 1983, Upper deck seats were $3.25. Now there's 75. Okay, well, even if you work God knows where, it was a half hour's wage, 20 minutes wage to go to a Cub game. Now it's 4 hours wage or 3 hours wage. It's a massive difference.
Yeah.
And I think some study like that would really open some eyes. Now, granted, you know, a car phone back then was a lot of dough. If you had one, it was 4 hours a month. Now it's 50. I mean, there's some stuff that's gone the other way. But by and large, S&P futures down 39, NASDAQ futures down 144. So we might see you next week. Is that the story?
I was with her in New York yesterday, and Maggie said next Wednesday we're going to go see Tom, right?
All right, we're going to order up some new earpieces and some new stuff, so you guys are looking at nice new mics and everything.
Ooh, we're going to come do an equipment check.
Yeah, S&P futures down 40. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.